Welcome to Inside Admission, the podcast that gives you a behind-the-scenes look at the college admission process with the experts in and around college admission.
Welcome to the Inside Admission podcast. I'm Andy Palumbo, and I'm thrilled to introduce today's guest, Ned Johnson, who is the author of What Do You Say? So, Ned, let's kick things off with you introducing yourself and sure. telling us a little bit about your work and the books you've authored.
Sure. I'm president and tutor geek at a company called Prep Matters. We do that dreary work of standardized test prep along with academic counseling and tutoring and so on and so forth. And my night job is as co-author with Dr. William Stixrud of a couple books, one, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives, and the book you just held up, What Do You Say? How to Talk with Kids to Build Motivation, Stress Tolerance, and a Happy Home. Bill, my writing partner, is a clinical neuropsychologist. And so he spends most of his time working with kids where, you know, things are harder than the folks would like them to be. You know, learning is hard, attention is hard, emotional or behavioral regulation. And he and I started lecturing maybe 10 years ago, maybe, about how do teenagers become intrinsically motivated. And spending time, we discovered we really liked the way we one another thought, kind of had similar thinking on things. And Bill at some point asked, you know, said maybe we should be writing some of this stuff down. And then we jumped into The Self-Driven Child. And after that, we just kind of jump all over the country, you know, in person when COVID, before COVID, just talking to folks about things that we think are more important than standardized tests. So there you go.
That's great. Thanks, Ned.
Sure.
So before we jump into today's topic, a rite of passage on this podcast is really diving into your own college search process and sharing with folks what that journey was like.
Well, I did it in a way, I've actually with an identical twin brother that would make most people in admissions crazy. We basically applied early decision to one school and had absolutely nothing lined up at all and miraculously got in there. My brother and I both attended Williams College. And so fortunately, we graduated high school in 1988, which if you look at the demographics, was the absolute demographic trough. So it was a great time to apply to college. I looked this up the other day, the admit rate at Stanford in 1988 was 22.4%, which is beyond luxurious by today's standards. Curiously, you know, we were benefits that we didn't know it at the time of legacy. My brother and I are fourth generation going to Williams, but we were also Pell Grant kids. So my family long ago had been, I gather, notable in some ways. And but then my experience growing up with my brother was much less rich, I think, than what had come before. So we knew that we attended a public high school on the Connecticut-Massachusetts border with about 100 kids in a graduating class. So we really weren't looking at big schools at all. And we'd heard about Williams because my grandfather had gone there. It was my estranged uncle, so I'd never had much of an experience. Mom said, why don't we go look there? So we just drove the, you know, 72 miles up to Williams. Took a look and said, this seems great. My mom's like, do you want to go look someplace else? Okay, nope, this seems great. And applied to one college and got in. And not too sophisticated, but fortunately it worked out well enough.
And it basically nothing's changed. That's exactly how the college admissions process should go now, right?
Yeah, I think
just
that's
find
right.
Your one school, apply, and, yep. and you're done. Yeah.
Put all your eggs in one basket and just go off and watch, spend all Sunday watching football and just keep your fingers crossed. That's what I did.
Well, that's one way to avoid stress and anxiety in the admissions process. So at least on the front end. So I do want to jump into something. So you mentioned, you know, your work in test prep, and I want to get right into that. I think we have some listeners who might be a little skeptical of your perspective. You know, goal of this podcast is to give our listeners and viewers who are largely students and parents going through this process the knowledge, tools, and guidance to navigate the process with less stress and with less anxiety. And so it's no secret that historically standardized tests have been one of the biggest drivers of that stress in this process. And, you know, having a career in the test prep arena, I think would lead folks to question, okay, what's this guy Ned going to tell us? Now, I followed your work and I've had the benefit of getting to know you. So that's exactly why I've asked you to be a guest in the podcast, because I think you have a really unique perspective to share with our listeners. And so I'd love for you to tell them how you view the work that you do and how it's it's in harmony with reducing stress and anxiety in this process.
Yeah, gosh, there's a lot to say in there. I mean, I think the first thing about standardized tests is that a lot of people want to think of them as objective measures. And a lot of people say, my gosh, they're not anywhere close to objective measure. And I'm more in the second camp, because from my experience and from what I've learned about, you know, psychology and neuroscience, you can't have a test that is objective when there are such wildly varying subjective experiences of taking that test, right? You know, the amount, some people do better with more pressure on them. Some people do better with less pressure. Some people come to the test with more pressure. Some people come with less pressure. And those make a really big difference. You and I were talking before we jumped on with this. Paul Tough, the terrific writer whose books include How Do Children Succeed? And recently, The Years That Matter Most, though, I guess retitled as The Inequality Machine, looks at the experience of kids going through the process of applying to college, getting into college, living in college, and just the wildly different experience that folks have. You know, really high affluent kids. He followed some of my students, and also kids who are really under resourced, including one pro bono kid. Shout out to Ben Dormus, who's now I think a junior at Yale. Just a great kid, incredible, incredible human being and learner, but without a lot of resources. And so the thing that I'm really interested in is, how do kids have healthy motivation? How do they have stress tolerance, meaning they can handle it and not be undone by this? One of the researchers Bill and I are big fans of is a woman named Sonia Lupien out of Montreal. And she has this beautiful acronym of what makes people nuts. And so N is novelty. So, hey, not just the coronavirus, it's the novel coronavirus. Isn't that terrific? You know, U is unpredictability. You know, so are you going to make it? Are you going to make it there or not? You know, will you make your flight or not? T, perceived threat. Before COVID made this, you know, everyone with potential, you know, assassin on the street. For mostly for kids, it was really threat to ego. Enter their parents. Like, wait, you got to what college? You know, that doesn't feel very good. Or your score was only, I thought you're, you know, kids often, they get the score back and they thought, but I thought I was so much smarter than this. And we give these ridiculous tests way more credit than they deserve. And then the last S is a low sense of control. And so good test prep, in my view, in my experience, is helping kids, you know, decrease the novelty, increase the predictability, lower the perceived threat, and give them a greater sense of control. And so they review content if they haven't seen this. You know, they work with me or take a class or buy a book or go on Khan Academy. They work on how to take the test. So you can do it the really nerdy way, or there's kind of this trick you can plug in numbers or whatever happens to be, which increases their sense of control about it. But I also spend a lot of time, I mean, I can argue passionately for the value in standardized tests, but I've spent a lot more time arguing about what the tests really don't do. Because for kids, they already have, most students that I see are already worked up enough. They already give this test more value than it deserves. And so by really talking down what this test is measuring, yeah, it's a hoop you may have to jump through, but this is not a test of your IQ, so on and so forth. By lowering the stress, we actually increase how kids do on this, because a little bit of pressure gets us engaged, but a lot of pressure can really undo us. So a lot of times people sort of said, you're like a test prep therapist. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of accurate, because I spent a lot of time trying to help kids understand what the test is and isn't, and also know more about themselves, you know, and talk. I mean, the amount of money that I've been paid to talk to kids about sleep deprivation, because I know that well-rested brains work better, perform better, are less stressed out than under-rested brains. So that's the kind of stuff that I spend a lot of time looking at. You know, one of the things that I think gets tied up in standardized tests, of course, is, you know, and Paul did a great job looking at the data, actually College Board data about this, about inequality, right? And you know, who kind of overperforms on tests and who underperforms on tests. And a curious thing from getting someone like me, yeah, having more resources helps. But from a stress perspective, it turns out that in many cases, affluent kids have just as much, if not more, stress than middle class and low SES kids, which makes a lot of people go, wait, you got to be kidding me, you know, poor little rich kid. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation did a study that came out in fall of 17 about the dominant sources of stress in adolescents. And the first four were poverty, that's not good, trauma. That's not good. Discrimination. Yeah, we spent the last couple of years really trying to look more at that. And then four, excessive pressure to excel. And one of the things that I worry about for all kids, including kids who have, you know, more resources than they probably even need, is just this chronic pressure on kids to excel, as opposed to developing themselves. You know, the line that Bill and I use is that from our perspective, the most important outcome of high school and adolescence is not where you go to college. And I know you work in the college admissions world, but it's not where you go to college. It's the brain that you develop that you then carry into college and you carry into adulthood. So I spend, you know, again, tests could be valuable to kids, but I am so happy about test optional. It's the best thing in the world because it now went from a thing where I have to do well on this ridiculous test to I may want to. And that could really help you. And that's awesome. But it's home run derby. You know, practice hard, swing for the fence. And you go, well, you just wasted, you understand, you wasted some time and some money. But your life is not, you know, oh my gosh, I can never go, because that's no longer true. Woohoo.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you about students developing the right type of brain, the right type of skills and resiliency. And I'm curious, you know, you touch on this in your recent book, but tell our listeners, you know, from your perspective, how important is agency for a student going through the college search process?
It's really, really important. So a couple of thoughts. I mean, one, Bill and I wrote a piece for the New York Times, I guess 3 years ago, it was a year or two before COVID, about the half dozen or so kids whom we knew who were home from college, first year of college, by Thanksgiving to stay, and they were done. And they'd washed out. And that's a heck of a way to spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $70,000. And well, I'm home for Thanksgiving. And these students had 201. They, you know, they could be very academic. They had the grades, the test scores, blah, blah, blah. But they simply didn't have enough experience running their own lives. They weren't prepared emotionally for running their own lives. And so agency is super important. And from our perspective, I'll talk about why in the college admissions process, but really through the whole darn experience of childhood and adolescence. This is really what the self-driven child is about. And the idea is simply this, that from a motivational perspective, specifically an intrinsic motivation perspective, I mean, I'm not doing it for carrots or sticks, risks or rewards, threats or promises. I'm doing it, I'm working hard. And not just that I work hard, but that I want to work hard. Intrinsic motivation, what's called self-determination theory, holds you have three needs that have to be met. You need psychological needs to feel competent, to sense of relatedness, and a sense of autonomy. And we spoke with Edward Deasy, one of the guys who put this forward, you know, decades ago, and said, it's our experience that autonomy piece is the most important. Is that right? And he said, hands down, in part because the longer kids are in school, the less autonomy they have. Kindergartners have more freedom than, you know, imagine being 17 years old. You got to raise your hand to go to the bathroom. It doesn't feel that respectful. But also from a stress perspective, you go back to that nuts, novelty, unpredictability, perceived threat, and a low sense of control. It's the low sense of control that is the worst thing you can experience. We can handle those first three so long as we feel like we have a sense of control. And it can feel like a bit of a zero-sum game, that when parents try to exert or feel more control, their kids feel less. There's a wonderful researcher out of UC Irvine named Jesse Borelli who did this experiment with kids doing a digital puzzle and a parent along for the ride. And the kids, they gave them a puzzle that looked easy and it actually was hard. Oh, well. In this case, it was moms. And they had the one instruction was just don't tell Andy how to do it. Don't tell Ned how to do it. You can say, you're doing great. Keep at it. You'll get there. Moral support, but no actual instructions. Again, looked easy, turned out hard. And the harder it seemed, the more stressed, the more frustrated kids got, the more stressed they got. And they could see this because they had heart rate monitors and their stress went up and up and up and up. And when kids were distressed, these loving moms, their stress went up because it's hard to sit on your hands, button your lip and watch your kids struggle.
Sure.
And eventually they all broke the cardinal rule and jumped in and said, no, Andy, over there, no, the other side. And when they did this, their stress went down because they finally were feeling a sense of control as their kids went up and up and up and up. And so it's not easy, but we really want to give kids as much control as they can, as much agency, to use your language, as we can, in part because It's going to be there 4 years. Yes, it's our money, but it's there 4 years. And we want them to own that choice, even if they make a suboptimal choice, like maybe it was better to go here than there. If it's their choice, then they own it and they struggle with it, as opposed to I make my kid go someplace else. And the first time, you know, they get in a fight with a roommate or get a bad grade, I told you this was going to be no good. And then they can be invested in their own failure. Let's not do that. These are near adults, right? They're 18, 19 going off into the world. We want to support them in having as much autonomy, as much agency as they can possibly stand, in my view.
And so getting to that that parent's natural urge to jump in, it's, I think, at least logically, as a parent, I can understand that. But, you know, a central question this podcast seeks to answer is, well, what should the role of the parent be in the college admissions process? And I think it's easy for us to at least clinically think about what it shouldn't be, right. But how can and should parents show up in this process?
Right. And part of it, I want to be as empathetic as I can. You know, I mean, you have a toddler and a 6 and an 8-year-old, right? Right now, your kids are not prepared to do that much, right? And so you control a lot for them. You do a lot for them. You know, we are wired as parents, as mammals, to protect our kids, to soothe them, to look out for them. And the challenge is simply, if they go from tots to teens, we should be doing less and less and less, because a kid who is successful in school because of us, oh boy, that's not a good outcome. The approach that we advocate in starting the Self-Driven Child and then our most recent book, What Do You Say?, is for parents to think of themselves as consultants to their kids. You know, they're the homework consultant, you know, the college essay consultant, rather than the manager, the boss, the person who's got to make it get done, right? And this consultant model really has three implications. One, you offer help, you offer advice, in part because when you ram stuff down kids' throats, it excites the stress response. And then the thinking part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is kind of goes offline. They go, which means I'm just trying to get this conversation to stop. And they're not going to hear it. Or kids will often work against what's in their own best interest simply because a low sense of control is so stressful. And they'll take the car of their life and drive in the tree just to prove that it's their car, kind of thing. So as a consultant, you offer help, I have a thought on this. Can I run this by you? Would it be okay if I helped you? And if they say no, then of course you shove it down their throat. No, I mean, you back away, right? You say, I'll bring it up in a weekend, you know, and if you need me, I'm here. Knowing that some kids are more sensitive, but some kids are less sensitive. Second thing is we want them to make their own decisions. Again, like we talked about with choosing a college, we want, because they have to own this, right? And lastly, when they make mistakes, which they will, we want to have them have the experience of solving that as much as they can with our help, but not our jumping in to solve it over and over and over. There's a wonderful researcher named Steve Mayer. He worked with Martin Seligman on what was known as learned helplessness. And they had a big paradigm paper they did it called Learned Helplessness at 50, kind of what they got right and what they got wrong. And the big thing that they got wrong, according to Mayer, was it wasn't that these animals were mistreated and then sat there in a cage being shocked and wouldn't walk out the door. It wasn't that they learned a sense of helplessness, but rather that they failed to learn a sense of control. Neurologically, the way that we develop this sense of agency, this sense of control, this stress tolerance, is by dealing with something that's challenging, it's stressful, and doing something for ourselves to fix it, right? Now, this could be with support, but if we constantly get saved over and over and over, you just become a basket case, constantly looking for someone to come and save you, as opposed to what do I do myself? So the great writer Tina Payne Bryson, who's probably most well known for The Whole Brain Child, has this lovely line where she says, adversity plus support becomes resilience. Adversity without support, that's trauma, right? And that's some of the kids that built that Paul talked about in his book, who just had every possible headwind and no one to help them. So our job as parents, you know, or any caregiver, teacher, whatever, is to offer help, offer advice, but don't take the steering wheel away from the kids, because if we deprive them of the experience of navigating this for themselves, we're missing this profound opportunity for them to wire their brains again, to have that stress tolerant and motivated brain that we desperately want them to have when they go off to college.
And so Ned, I think that all makes sense. Yet here we are in the midst of an uncertain global pandemic with mandates being forced upon students with, you know, whether it's social distancing, masking, isolation from friends, maybe 1 week you're in person, maybe 1 week you're remote. you know, it just strikes me as maybe the most challenging environment, you know, in the modern era. And how can students build a stress tolerance with all of this going around, and specifically considering the pandemic, how can parents help their students in that?
Well, there's first of all, again, we want to keep reminding ourselves of two things for me, of the enormous individual differences, right? I mean, one of the is a Kiki Gilbert, who's in Paul's book, and I was just reading this the other day, you know, who was, she described, you know, poor Black and from single mom. And when she realized that these were three strikes against her in getting a first rate education, she said, my fourth grade little mind was racked with fury. And we need to really be honest about that. And even, you know, kids who are of the same socioeconomic level, you know, you have a mom who's sick or a dad who's lost a job, dad who's sick, mom who's lost a job. I mean, there's just, it's all over the place in terms of what kids are experiencing. And also, some kids just by their design roll with things more easily. And some kids, the same experience, really get pancaked. And so we want to keep that in mind. For me, one thing that we want to do is if you feel overwhelmed, I mean, the opposite of a sense of control, right? The opposite of a sense of control, a healthy sense of control, is feeling helpless or hopeless or passive or overwhelmed by life. And it makes a ton of sense that a lot of kids right now and parents and teachers and administrators who just feel overwhelmed. And for me, and I know some people don't like this, but for me, we lower our expectations for now. For now, we lower expectations because people think, but we have to keep these grades. It's not true. It's not true that you have to keep these grades. You want to keep these grades, but it is not true. And for anyone who thinks that grades matter more than mental health, I'll fight you. That's the hill that I'll die on. And I'll say, you know, my experience, I grew up, I had a father who was an alcoholic. I had a mother who was institutionalized for her mental health. I spent 3 months of seventh grade in a pediatric psychiatric hospital. Went from this tiny school that I got the best grade on every test and every essay and every class and everything I did. And then I did nothing. Nothing. School refusal, nothing, right? But I came back, you know, eighth grade and then into high school. And I did very well because, you know what? I still wanted my life to work out. So that same Sonia Lupien with a nut, she said, one of the single best ways to lower stress is to have a plan B. Of course you should apply early decision to Harvard. It's fabulous. You look great in crimson. Who wouldn't want that? But let's have a good plan B, right? And this is what great college counselors do, is they basically sell insurance. They don't tell a kid, you're never getting to Harvard. Don't waste your time. They say, of course, you know, you're a great kid. You've worked hard. You should stretch for that. But let's just make sure that we have a parachute, right? Let's have a plan B. And so when I think about kids struggling with school right now, we want to remind ourselves that that can be okay for now. I literally got an email on Sunday from a former student of mine who went to, in DC, there's a place called the Lab School, which is for kids with really significant, mostly language-based learning disabilities. And everything was hard for him. And he was really well supported, I would say too supported. And his parents did the stuff over and over and over, you know, and a million tutors. You'll love this experience. So we were doing, in his case, he was very strong linguistically, but hard for me to say, but mathematically, just not good. So we've done all this reading stuff on the ACT so we can get a little momentum, a little bit of confidence. And it's going to be our first foray into math section. So I give him the first 20 on the ACT. So for people who may not know, there's 60 questions. They go easy to hard. So the first 20 are questions that most kids could feel pretty confident in, like seventh grade. He's in 11th grade. He comes back. They're perfect. I was like, huh, unexpected. Tell me about those. Oh, yeah, no, yeah, this went well. Oh, but I got Jake to help me. Awesome. Who's Jake? Oh, Jake's my other tutor. Question for you. Do you lift weights? So this guy is like 6'2 and 210. I mean, he's big, strapping. He lifts weights, right? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, remind me how spotting works. And he goes, oh, because he got nothing. I mean, he got something out of it. I'm sure this other tutor is really quite good, but we don't want to work harder, right, than our kids do to make this work. And so fast forward, he goes, I get this email. He went to college and he flamed out predictably after one semester. He then was out of college for a year and a half. He then went to community college for 2 years and then transferred to University of Maryland and just graduated in December from University of Maryland. It took him 7 years to get through 4 years of college. And you know what? That's fine, in part because for him, he was waiting for that prefrontal cortex to fully develop. And so 7 years of college, in and out of college, is no one's plan A, right? Going from a straight A student to a C or a D student, which a lot of kids have done during this, is no one's plan A. But we do better when we lower our expectations, say, this is good enough for now. And this was me all the way. I mean, I was top student in high school. And then college, things kind of went off the rail. And I maintain my sanity to the degree that I'm not insane by saying, well, it's good enough. It's good enough. It's good enough. It's good enough. And in, for a lot of parents feel like my kid's not working, my kid's not taking this seriously, and I need to lean on them harder. Curiously, a lot of kids avoid the dominant manifestation of anxiety is avoidance. And if you feel overwhelmed by things, you just, you hide away from, you deny, you miss it. And in fact, if we can look for the kids who are in that boat, if we can lower the pressure and say, it's fine, kiddo, it's totally fine. You don't have to, you know, you may want to, but you don't have to. We actually can increase their motivation. If you don't believe me, there's all the science is on my side. You can read about it. And so for all the, I mean, and it's hard because parents are leaning on teachers. Why don't do this? And I mean, everyone is stressed out. And from my perspective, the best thing that a parent can do, a teacher can do, an administrator can do is simply to take the long view and say, you know, everyone's doing the best they can for now, for now.
Enjoying the podcast? Find us on the web at InsideAdmissionPodcast.com. And you can find and engage with us on social media, where our handle is InsideAdmission on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Now, back to the pod.
We approach the college search process. You know, students, parents, both spend so much time, you know, thinking about that college search, building the list, you know, maybe visiting schools if that's possible, applying, then making that final decision. It's easy to get swept up in all that. And how can parents ensure that during the college admissions process, their family is still able to appreciate that time they have together before there's really a major change in the parent-child relationship and family dynamic?
It's a really good question. I had a parent this couple, 3 years ago who, you know, ruefully said, I really regret that I spent the last year of my kid, you know, being on him about his grades and college admissions as opposed to just enjoying him. Because it's the last year I had with him. And it's hard because, again, if we go back to, you know, as parents, we're wired to care about our kids and to fuss and worry about them because we love them. It's our job to soothe and protect them. But, right, we want to be mindful of this. And so part of it is our fear about this whole college admissions process is that it's this sorting process that if you go here, it's untold success and happiness and riches. And if you go this other way, it's some, you know, kind of B minus C plus quality life. And I am as much as I love, you know, Paul's book and Raj Chetty's stuff, I'm a much bigger fan of Kruger and Dale and all this literature that shows that where you go to college is very poorly statistically correlated to wealth, to success, to happiness, as opposed to what do you do when you're there? Are you connected to a professor? Are you doing an activity that transcends a semester? So I just want to remind us that because most of our fears as parents are not about the present, they're about the future, that this will take my kids someplace terrible. And I just couldn't live with that. So a lot of it is working on our own fears. Part of it, though, is prioritizing our relationship, you know, and if we can take the long view on this, and particularly if you have kids who are struggling, try to make it a high priority just to enjoy their presence. Again, my partner, Bill, works with all these kids where things are hard, and he was talking with this kid who was 19 or 20, and he'd failed out of college a couple of times. Things were just really hard. And Bill is asking him about, you know, his high school. He said, when you think back on this, is there something that your parents could have done that would have helped you? And the kid stopped and he said, it would have been nice if they were happy to see me once in a while. And the challenge is, I think, as parents, when things aren't going well, we're so worried about that, understandably. But also, it can feel like it's our job to disapprove of the things that aren't going well. You know, kids are substance use disorders and grades and everything else. But if we can, it's, you know, to separate those things, and I'm not cool with what this is, but I love you no matter what you do. I love you no matter how hard you work. Love you no matter where you go to college. That continuous iteration of unconditional love is really important, particularly right now when so many kids are really struggling. because we often have the, I think of parents that won't say it, but it'd be easier for me to love my kid if they were doing better. Where true, but it would also be easier for them to do better if they felt loved. In terms of kind of a practical thing getting through this college admissions thing is kids can feel bombarded. Like, you know, for all of senior year, every person, you know, feels like every single adult, all that's, where are you going to college? Where are you applying to college? Where are you applying to college? Where are you applying to college? And that drip feed can be really intense for kids. Trust me when I say that if you have a kid who's planning to go to college, they're thinking about it enough. It may not look like it because they may be avoiding because of anxiety, or they may be ADHD, in which case they're going to do everything at the last possible moment and make you nuts, but it doesn't mean they're not thinking about it. So my one practical piece of advice would be this. With your kid, sit down on a Sunday afternoon and make a plan for, can we have a weekly or bi-weekly or whatever time where we touch base about college stuff? Let's spend, you know, Saturday or Sunday from, you know, 2 to 3 talking through this stuff, making sure that things are on pace, that you're talking, you've gotten your recommendations, that your essay is going well, that you've talked to counsel, whatever, right? I had a kid a few years ago, he's a recruited athlete, lacrosse guy. But typical boy, he did everything in the last possible moment. His mother was the loveliest person in the world. I just love her to pieces. But her wiring was that she was fretful. And so every day, did you email this guy? Did you text him back to email? Because this kid's getting bombarded with like 100 colleges wanting to go and play lacrosse, right? And she was so worried that he'd fail to respond to Cornell or whatever, that he'd blow it. I get it. He's a teenage boy. He's playing lacrosse. He's chasing girls. Right? I get it. And I simply said to that, I said, pick Tuesday night and Sunday to do this. And she said it made a world of difference because then I didn't have the unpredictability. If we go back to the nuts, right? I felt a greater sense of control, but so did my kid. He felt more sense of control. So dinner on Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday wasn't going to be about, did you email the coach? It's like, oh my gosh, they could just enjoy one another's company. And then a couple times a week. And again, she played consultant. She had organization out the wazoo. So she just had her list. Did you do it? Yep. Did you do that? Oh, I forgot that one. Thanks for reminding me. And we changed the energy in ways that actually makes a lot more successful than constantly being on your kid. Because it's not fun for a parent. You feel like, you know, I'm such a jerk. And trust me, your kids probably don't love it either. I'm just kidding.
So we typically end each episode with a piece of advice, any advice you think is helpful for both students and then for parents.
Well, you know, with kids, it's hard. A lot of parents will say, look, I'm not putting the pressure on them. The kids, you know, my kids are. The kids are putting it on themselves. It's their peer group. That's true. That's true. You know, Jeff Salingo, who I know you interviewed, talked about that with kids looking at a school and then, you know, thinking about this and they float it to their friends and the friends like, I've never heard of that. They cross it off the list. So we end up with kids all trying to apply to the exact same school. And in the what's called the DSM, which is the handbook of psychological disorders, the most recent one that came out 10 years ago, there was a new diagnosis. This is great. And it was the shared delusional disorder. Meaning that if I grew up in a family where everyone wore, you know, tinfoil hats and conspiracy theorists, right, I'd probably adopt some vaguely unconventional ideas about what our government is up to, right? But we also live in a place where people think, you know, if you don't go to an Ivy League school, you'll never be successful. And there are people who, honest to gosh, believe that. And it's delusional thinking. I mean, a lot of families I work with, they, you know, we actually believe that people who go to Ivy League schools are better than other people. Okay. But we want to talk, we really want to talk back against that. And I encourage kids to do that. And, you know, go and look Kruger and Dale, Kruegger and Dale, and just read it for yourself, right? Because most mental health is changing thinking from I have to I want to. I have to is crazy making and can lead to some very, very bad outcomes versus I want to. And goodness knows, I want kids to be as successful as they can be, to work as hard as they can academically, because it's good for them. It's good for their development. It's good for their families, their schools. It's good for the whole darn country for kids to work hard. But if you have the idea that I have to, I mean, the perfect recipe for stress and anxiety and getting really bad outcomes is I have to, but I can't, right? And so I just want to change that from I have to I want to. The other thing that I would say for kids right now is that from a neurological perspective, from a mental health perspective, if you have more inflows of stress into your life than you have healthy, and I'll say healthy outflows of stress, bad things happen. This is what's correlated between the rampant substance use disorder and in increasingly in high school and in college, you know, to suicidal ideation, just everything bad. And so it's a really great idea to talk to your school counselor. If you have a mental health club at school, to talk with your friends, to talk with your mom, your dad, your coach, whatever. What do you do to blow off stress in a healthy way? And the biggest thing for me, and again, I had this background, so I'm really vulnerable to depression. And so, and I like being, you know, shiny, happy net. I don't like being depressed because it's just, it's a dark place to be. So I'm about as committed to being well-rested as anyone on the, at least in the DC area is. You know, I exercise on a daily basis and I practice what's called transcendental meditation. And if I go one night of 6 hours of sleep, I am not a nice human being. And I am just so concerned about the degree of sleep deprivation in kids. And if the one takeaway that I wish all these schools had learned last year is that when we were all virtual and we started later, kids got more sleep. And when kids get more sleep, everything goes better. So that'd be the big thing for me is to push on it. If kids, if they can, talk with people who are in charge about how do we organize our lives so we get more sleep. And for parents, again, just reminding ourselves that, you know, we want to take the long view on this. And one of the long views for me is that kids, parents, they say, I just want my kid to be happy. I just want my kid to be happy. And there's a, in our book, What Do You Say? There's a chapter on talking with kids about the pursuit of happiness. And it opens with a story about Bill. He was in Dallas, Texas, talking to some an independent school there and all these kind of student government kids. And he asked them, how many of you want to be happy as adults? And they all kind of sheepishly raised their hands like, duh. And he said, well, great. Well, what do grownups tell you it's necessary to be happy as an adult? And this kid raises his hand, and every answer was some version of, well, if we get into a good enough college, then everything else will fall into place. And I thought, oh my gosh, how could they be so wrong? I mean, I'll give Yale a hard time. If that were the case, people at Yale would be among the happiest people in the world, as opposed to 60% of them, you know, seeking out mental health, you know, help. And Lori Santos needing to launch a class, the most oversubscribed class in the history of Yale, on how to be happy. And so there's a wonderful research, Martin Seligman, who's the father of positive psychology, and just you can file this away, a formula, scientifically proven, psychologically proven for happiness, and it's PERMA. So P is positive emotions, and some of us are more glass half full than others, but you can practice gratitude, all sorts of things for positive emotion. E is engagement, the flow state, you know, the passionate pursuit of pastimes, not just school. R is relationships, M is meaning, and A is achievement. And achievement makes a big difference, right? You know, to get into, you know, WPI is a fantastic thing and you darn well better be happy because doggone it, right? You know, and getting money and awards and likes on this, I get all that, but it's 1/5 of the equation. And so when we say, why would you play soccer? You're never going to be a college recruiter. You're spending out so much time with your friends. You should be working on your grades. And we're wiping out engagement and we're wiping out relationships and we're wiping out meaning. And because brains develop in the ways that they're used, we just don't want kids who achieve everything and they get to college and struggle in all sorts of ways with mental health. And they can have achieved everything and still not be happy because they think that the formula for happiness is relentless pursuit of achievement. And achievement is important. It's part of it. And we want kids to work hard. But goodness knows, we all know that life is more than that. And we can start at a lot earlier age to talk with kids and support them in the pursuit of things that actually do bring them happiness.
Well, this was a fascinating conversation, Ned. Before we go, why don't you let folks know where they can find you and your books online?
Well, that Bezos guy, here is a website that can help. We always suggest the independent bookstores. And I should say, let me find this really quickly. There is, I just got an email from our publisher. There's going to be the Kindle book of What Do You Say is going to be on sale for like $1.99 on Kindle. Sometime in February, I think it was February 18th. I'll dig this up. We can put that in the notes. Or, all those local, you know, if you're going to buy the book in hardback, we always love people going to independent bookstores because, you know, we love independent bookstores. To find me, I'm on social media, Ned Johnson on Twitter. I started TikTok.
I saw
a few weeks ago, and I had this one video that went a little viral. So now, according to my kids, I'm TikTok famous. So that was pretty fun. And I have a
little dance, right, Ned?
Oh yeah. You guys see my moves, right? It's basically about why do kids procrastinate? It's pretty fun. And then the other Ned Johnson is both my website and my TikTok handle, because the Ned Johnson is the guy who founded Fidelity, so I didn't get that. It's the 18th of February. The book will be $1.99 for that day on Kindle for people who have Kindle.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast, Ned. I appreciate it.
I love the work that you're doing there, Andy. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks, Ned.
Enjoying the podcast? Find us on the web at InsideAdmissionPodcast.com. And you can find and engage with us on social media, where our handle is InsideAdmission on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.